drink too much, though.
Yeah, you can hear me? All right. So my name is Yana Caroline. I'm 32 years old. And today is the 18th of May, 2010. We are in New York. My relationship to partner, I'm Lindsay's husband.
My name is Lindsay Cuff. I am turning 30 in 3 weeks. It's, what did you say it was? May 18th?
I think it's May
2010, yeah. And we are in Lower Manhattan, New York, and I am Yana's wife.
Okay. Well, I'm going to start with like this broad question, but specific to the work. So how do you come up with your ideas? Where that come from?
My ideas, like for what to do during the day, or my ideas for my work?
Yeah, for your work. Like every time you come up with a song or a book or an idea or like a dialogue or anything.
I think I have a very curious and voracious mind. So I'm always observing and watching and reading and listening, and just, I also, as you know, have a good memory. So I have this little cache of things that I store, and somehow they get processed and come out the other end. So yeah, I would say like little sort of everyday details. That's where I get my ideas.
You know, your ideas, you say they come from like a lot of different places. Do you know how they come out? Do you know usually like preview how they come out, since you're like a writer, a songwriter, musician?
Like what form my ideas take?
Yeah.
I think the idea like demands what it will become. So,
do you have an example?
Yeah, like, for example, the songs that I write actually tend to be about probably the simplest things, more like purely emotional content. It's very rare that a philosophical or intellectual idea that I have will become a song. It's funny. Yeah, it's like definitely a more sort of, it's where I let myself be more poppy, I guess you could say.
Even though you have a hard time doing it, but you still you still try to get to the poppy side.
Yeah, you know, like it'll be about like, normally my songs are about love and longing for sure.
Yeah.
But yeah, like for example, when I wrote the opera libretto, that idea was first kind of, I saw an article in the newspaper that was about a woman who woke up during surgery. But couldn't tell anybody that she woke up. And I thought that this was really interesting, this idea. And so then I just kind of start, I don't know what that's going to end up into, but I'm curious about it. So I start to think about it. And then I started to think about the body and how it plays tricks on us. And then I started to like research tricks, and that led to hoaxes, which led me to Houdini. And so I started thinking about how magic is related to anesthesia and surgery. And so then I also stumbled upon this man who teleported in the 16th century. So then I was like, oh, what am I going to do with all these things? How am I going to unite them? So then I tried to write a short story that was in three voices, but it didn't really work for me. Like it needed something else. It needed something more experimental. It felt like I wanted them to all sing in a choir, but they couldn't do that in the story. So then I decided to try and make them sing and wrote an opera libretto. So I think it's like, it's all part of the process, what comes out in the end.
So what is that process? Yeah, you know, when you go leave home and go to your to your little studio, what is that process going?
I think it's a combination of like researching, thinking, and just trying. Like I said, I tried to write a short story first of that piece.
Yeah, I remember.
And it didn't. Yeah, you read the short story. Yeah, and it was good, but it could have gone farther. So, yeah. So what do I actually physically do? Is I sit with a cup of coffee and my computer.
It's always a mystery, you know. Yeah. Writer, how does a writer, you know, a musician, you can imagine like being on the keys, and the writer, like, right, but actually there's something else that they do, I guess, you know.
Yeah, like, I guess. I mean, the process starts like on my bike or on the subway. I just like ruminate over things for long periods of time, and like it's usually in motion that I'm thinking about
Interesting.
It.
Interesting.
Yeah, like walking or biking or on the subway, and like going over things and putting things together. And so then when I sit down at my computer, I'll start with like a very small sort of seed just to start getting my thoughts into a written form. Mm. So I'll start writing on just any topic and then see what emerges. Or I mean, for the novel that I just started like covering my walls in post-its with ideas and threads and characters and yeah. But it's funny because I'm not sure that novel will end up being a novel.
Oh.
Yeah.
What do you think it's going to be?
I don't know. Like, I'm approaching it right now as if it's going to be a novel. But it's a novel that's based on sound, so I'm actually creating sound archives that are going to be threaded into the narrative. So the protagonist is discovering these sound archives of his grandfather. So I kind of started writing it just in a normal way, trying to like make my prose highly based on sound. But then I sort of stepped back from it and started creating the actual tapes and then writing these small moments of prose around the tapes themselves. And I am so enjoying that process of just these like moments in time that I don't know, it can almost be a play or a performance piece. So.
Oh, so it needs to be spoken, it needs to be out loud, it needs to be heard.
Yeah, I mean, at first I thought my biggest challenge and the most interesting challenge was going to be to convert the sound into prose. But now, I don't know. I'm not sure. It's hard to say too much about it because it might very well be a novel. But I think I'm open to it also being other things that do involve story and sound. And maybe it'll be a listening experience, like a serial that someone gets, you buy like one thing at a time. Who knows?
Well, that's what happened to the MCC Open Studio last time. You had to read this part of your book, part of your research. Did that like change or like bring something new to this thinking, this new direction?
Yeah, I mean that's a good question because it definitely, in talking to people after, and it seemed like they really responded to the sound, and especially I incorporated one of the tapes in the reading, and people really responded to that, to the sound of the voice. Like, I mean, Roland Barthes, his expression, the grain of the voice. I think there's something so interesting and so evocative about the voice itself, the human voice, and that's so much of what my work is concerned with is the voice and what it holds and what it can carry and the intersections between the speaking voice, the singing voice, and the written voice. Can the voice be present in words? Or what happens when you actually make the voice present itself?
So it's almost like reliving what you, the experience that you had with the opera the first time when you wrote a short story, and then you needed a voice into those people, into those action, and you end up making an opera, and you feel like you have the same needs, and like when you wrote this novel, and since it needs to be said or loud.
Yeah, I mean, Maybe it will become an opera.
You're doomed to be an opera. Yeah, librettist.
I wanted to do something that was like kind of mainstream for once.
You can't.
Novels sell. Operas do not. Experimental operas.
Experimental opera even more.
But yeah, I mean, text is equally as important to me as sound. So yeah, I think that's very much a part of my work, is sort of fooling around in those intersections and kind of seeing what comes.
Well, talking about those intersections, I mean, it's I've seen, like, I had the chance of seeing lots of your work. I've seen you, like, singing folk song, playing guitar in a folk band and, in folk festivals. Seen you playing experimental music, singing classical, writing essays, like philosophical essays, and writing libretto, and all these different kind of medium. Is there anything that thread through all of those, that you can, a theme that you can like extract from all of those different medium that you use, all of those different place that you express yourself? There's something that still remain besides you.
Yeah, like sort of themes that kind of run through all of those.
Yeah,
things,
it comes
or
back.
Something
is,
that keeps coming back.
Yeah.
Like a leitmotif.
Something like that. Like a leitmotif.
I love that word.
I know.
I think like something that keeps coming back, and I'm not exactly sure why. I mean, there's probably lots of reasons why. But is something to do with grief and loss and memory. And I mean, you mentioned like singing in a folk band. It was the song that I was type of songs I was most interested in. It was murder ballads, which I find so fascinating, this history of murder ballads, because it's like something people are singing about, something that is dark and not spoken about and gritty but real. And that happens. And singing about it embraces that loss and that sort of dark side of human nature. The experimental music, I mean, I guess we can call it that, for I play the more minimalist sort of instrumental music, definitely has this sort of thread of melancholy, which I believe is like deeply related to loss. The latest short story that I read that is about someone losing their husband but not being able to admit that they lost it, and therefore is obsessed with Kevin Costner. It's about this loss. So I guess I am interested in that, and about how that can be inherited by people and how that can be passed on, and how we speak to each other in that, how we hold it and bear witness to it. And
do you have any clue why? Do you have any clue where that comes from?
Yeah, I mean, I, like anyone, have experienced loss, like, in my life, for sure. At a young age, I was in the room with my best friend when her mother died, and went through that whole experience of grieving and loss with her at a pretty young age. And actually, I started to write poetry about it at the time, which is interesting. But everybody around me, everybody that I come in contact with, like you, my close friends, people that I don't even know, I mean, we all experienced this, some more than others, but it's kind of a matter of when, you know?
Yeah, but we all experience also many other things. Why this one became like something that you attaches you, or like that you want to work on?
Yeah. I guess it's something so stripped down. It's something at the very sort of basic thing of human experience, I think. And I think it's something that is really hard to share in words. You know, we can share our happiness with people. We can talk about it, you know, when you catch up with your friend on the phone after not talking to them for a while. But loneliness and grief is something that we make such a bigger deal out of it. We hold it to ourselves and feel like we can't talk about it, even though it's just another, you know, human experience, human emotion. So I guess what intrigues me about it and what makes me keep wanting to excavate it and come back to it is how do we memorialize that? How do we move on? How do we stay stuck? How do we pass it on from generation to generation, like, and in a collective way just as much as in a personal way? You know, it's been interesting, like, working in Lower Manhattan lately and, you know, feeling this sort of, like, heaviness still. Walking past the, like, World Trade Center and feeling like, I don't know, like something has changed. Or in our studio space that's in this, like, empty office space where you can still see the shadows of the cubicles. It's like something has happened, something has been lost. It feels kind of post-apocalyptic in a way. And that's total stripped downness and decay. I'm interested in it because, yeah, it's not often something we give voice to.
And you want to give that voice. So,
yeah. Yeah.
Have you experienced loss personally? I mean, outside of your friend's loss?
Yeah.
Can you speak about that a little bit?
Yeah. I experienced the loss of my grandfather, who was probably the closest person to me in my family.
Tell me about your grandfather.
Yeah. My grandfather was a very interesting man. Yana never actually got to meet him, which is too bad. Mm-hmm. But he's kind of like one of these outlaw type of people in his own way. He was he was from Newfoundland. I'm Canadian. But he moved to Toronto when he was like 18 or 19. And eventually he became a Salvation Army minister, ordained in the Salvation Army. But he never was really suited to sort of working within a church or an organization. So what he would do is he would just go to the homeless shelters or the pubs, and he would just like hang out with people and at the end of the night like put out his hat and get collection from everyone as they stumbled home drunk from the bar. He was this kind of man who, you know, would fish every day at 5 a.m. and would have this whole, his own little congregation of people, and yeah, and would give you the shirt off his back, would give you anything, yeah. So him and I don't know, it was actually near the end of his life, I started to notice that the conversations that we were having were changing, and yeah, and he wanted to talk more. I mean, you were telling me earlier about your grandma, how she was suddenly talking about things that were in the far past. But he wanted to talk about like cosmology and philosophy, and it was weird because he wouldn't really talk to anybody else in the family about it, but it was like he had chosen me to talk about this with. So he wanted to talk about like black holes and
how old were you?
20.
20?
Yeah.
So you were able to engage with him and
yeah, totally. And he wanted to talk a lot about like Newfoundland and about fishing, but he would ask me questions like, what do you think about this? And what do you think about this? And I went to Nepal when I was 20 as well by myself and was hiking around, and when I came back he wanted to know everything about it and wanted to know my observations about it and just wanted to kind of live that life through me. And so yeah, actually talking about my grandfather, I was talking earlier about the opera and how one of the characters underwent anesthesia. Part of the reason I was very curious about anesthesia at the time is because when my grandpa died, I was having surgery and was under anesthesia. And is that how you pronounce that word? I never know. I'm asking you, the Frenchman, how to pronounce the word anesthesia. Anyways, I was under. Mm-hmm. And we had like this meeting when I was under. And when he gave me my violin that I have when I was 12 years mm-hmm. old, my full-size violin. So in this dream or whatever, he asked me to play violin for him, and so I played violin for him, and we said goodbye. And then I woke up, and the surgery was done, and I went home, and there was a message on my phone that he had died while I was in surgery. So, I don't know. It's kind of crazy. Yeah.
How did you feel when that happened, when you woke up after surgery?
I felt really calm. I felt like I knew what had happened, and I was cool with it and happy that I had been able to say goodbye in whatever way. Yeah.
Did you talk about it to your parents or to people around you about this experience?
I talked to a few people around me. I don't think I actually talked to my parents about it. I'm not sure if I did. Maybe I did. Yeah.
And how was the reaction from people from when you tell that?
I think, well, like, my family was pretty sort of caught up in their own grief at the time, and so I think they were like, that's beautiful, but then kind of forgot about it. But I think other people, when I talked to other people about it, it opened up experiences that they had had under anesthesia as well, more about that. So, yeah. So what I guess when you're talking about what intrigues me about grief and loss and all those things is it's also contained in, so much I think is contained in the subconscious or the unconscious. So I think this moment when I was under anesthesia,
is able to reach it.
Yeah.
Talk to it.
Totally.
Have you ever wrote about that besides the opera?
I did try to write about it. I tried to include it in part of an essay, but it got kicked out. Yeah. It hasn't really been written about. Yeah. So
there's a question that I want to ask you for a while about your work, and if we can go back to that, how do you think about your audience or your readers when you write, when you work, when you create? Do you ever think about the people who's going to receive your work?
At a certain stage in the writing I do, but not at the beginning at all. Yeah, in the beginning, it's really just kind of like me alone in a room, and it's a very like solitude practice for me. I mean, I can't write with other people around in my head or around me physically. I need to be alone. But I mean, at a certain stage in the process, like after a draft has been made, I think then I will start to think about more things like structure and timing, which I think is implicit in thinking about the audience.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I'll read things out loud, and it's for me to hear it, but it's also, I kind of imagine somebody standing outside my door and overhearing me read it. And I kind of wish, actually, that readings were like that. That they were like overhearings instead of readings. I feel like that's kind of how work is like meant to be received.
Almost more intimate.
Yeah. Exactly. It's like, yeah, the writer is still alone with their work. I really feel like the act of writing as well as the act of reading are both really solitary acts. Mm-hmm. And so they can be intimate by the sort of overhearing connection, which is like, what I think is really cool about radio is that it's created in sort of a solitude, but then gets transmitted into all of these homes and places and desks where the person has their own intimate experience, but they're somehow connected.
Yeah. Yeah, you worked in a radio station for a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah.
There was that experience that makes you feel that way?
Yeah. I mean, that was definitely you don't think about it in the moment. So I think it wasn't really that experience that made me think about it. It was more like just thinking about it philosophically, actually, than in the action of it. I mean, reading things written by Beckett or also by Glenn Gould, who's one of my heroes, as you know. Yeah.
So back to the audience, what do you want to create or provoke in your audience and your readers?
It's a hard question.
I know. We never talked about that. That's why I wanted to approach that.
Yeah. I mean, I'm definitely interested in creating something beautiful that can touch them, but I don't think, I'm so hesitant to use the word beautiful because I think it implies certain things that I'm not wanting to imply. Like when I say that word, I'm more thinking about, I guess, like the darker side of beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know, like a real intimate sort of moment of communication, whether it's between me and that person or the audience, or that audience and the person that's sitting beside them, just want, like, for one moment while they're receiving my work, for them to maybe engage in their own lives and the lives around them in a deeper way. Just so, I guess, a deepening. That's, I wish for a deepening.
The communication of it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you mentioned the discussion you had with your grandfather about India, about, like, the last moment of
black holes.
Black holes.
He was obsessed with them.
Did that ever come back, the black holes in your work?
No, I totally forgot about that until right now.
Did you think the conversation was strange that you were having with your grandfather? Did you know he was ill or?
Oh, around the times. No, I mean, and this was the strange thing about his death is that nobody knew he was ill. He being like any rural Newfoundlander didn't really trust doctors like them. And I think he was also resistant to go to the doctor because I think he knew that there was some things going on. And I really believe that he made a choice to just live his life to the end how he wanted to live it and not be in the hospital. Like, he basically, the day that he went to the hospital and never came back out, he went fishing that morning and, like, caught some fish and gave them to his friend Ming and then went to the hospital, you know. But I remember I had been living on Vancouver Island at the time, and I came to visit, and we had like a family dinner in IKEA, you know, one of those intimate IKEA family dinners. And my grandfather just was sitting beside me, and there was this total clear moment where I knew that he wasn't going to be around much longer.
You understood.
Yeah, he just kept looking me, instead of being his usual, like, so, Lindsay, what do you think about the new discovery of the crop circles in this town or whatever? It was like, he just kept looking at me and saying, like, do you know that you are an amazing person? Do you know how much I enjoy talking to you and how much you inspire me? Like, it was like he needed me to know in that moment how important that I was to him. Like, and there was such an urgency to this. It's like, of course I knew that. But it was the urgency in him needing to tell it to me that I just totally knew that something was not right. So my parents drove me back to the ferry, and I said to them in the car, like, I think that grandpa's really sick, and I don't know if I'm going to see him again. And he went to the hospital like before I saw him again. I did see him again in the hospital, but he was already really sick. Like, at that point, I just came into the hospital and he just basically squeezed my hand. And yeah.
So there was basically the moment IKEA and the, and the violin and the anesthesia was like the two moments.
Yeah. He ended up dying of lung cancer, which they think was from working in asbestos plants in Toronto in the 50s.
What is the asbestos?
Because he never smoked. It's like this thing that they use in installation, but it's toxic. And it's like a fiberglass, and it can get into your lungs. But they diagnosed him with tuberculosis. So, I mean, when he was younger, tuberculosis was like a death sentence. So he never ended up having tuberculosis, but I think he sort of like threw in the towel when he got diagnosed as that. Yeah.
Do you talk about his past in when he was working with him? Yeah.
With like him? His past in...
working for the asbestos plants and all
that. No. I just found that out. Yeah, you know, family, whatever. Yeah. It was also like, I don't know. He didn't really talk much about Toronto, except for this one story that he loved to tell about how when he first arrived in Toronto, he was staying in this men's hostel, and someone asked him if he wanted to play baseball. And then he asked them, amateur or professional? The person started laughing. So my grandfather like loved to tell this story as an example of how far he had come, you know, from that first arrival. So, but the funny thing is, I mean, and I have written about that actually. Yeah, the funny thing is that when he told the story, he still had like a Newfoundland accent. So,
yeah. It sounds like.
Oh God.
Do you have any?
Are you hungry, my love? It's very Irish. It's like, yeah, it's very like, bye. We've been fishing bye all day. We didn't really catch anything. But so yeah, when he would tell the story, it would be like, Lindsay Dare arrived in the hostel and he asked me, amateur or professional? It's the same. I wish I could do it better. I need to study up.
Yeah.
Yeah. Another funny thing, just like as a side note about Newfoundlanders and how they talk, is that, I mean, they say my love a lot, but they also call everyone fellas. Like, so last time my mom and I were there, it was really hilarious to be addressed as fellas, like fellas. My mother and I. You fellas hungry? And I'd be like looking around. Oh, us. Now we're good.
Yeah, you went back to Newfoundland, eh?
Mm-hmm.
How was that experience?
It was amazing. Yeah. It was really, really amazing. Mm-hmm. I felt instantly connected to the landscape, which is very, like, I mean, very stark and beautiful. You see all these abandoned fishing stages, which is people used to fish there, but the cod fisheries collapsed, so it's, you know, there's a lot of like decay in the industry there, but the landscape is still so stunning. Mm-hmm. So fishing stages are these like little sheds where they used to park their boats and keep their fishing equipment. And they're all scattered along the road, but they're like dilapidated and half falling apart. So.
Did you meet anybody from your family, from your grandfather's family there?
Yeah, totally. Yeah. My uncle Wallace, who walks with a cane and is... very not well. Kind of brought us around Musgrave Harbor, the town my grandfather's from, and showed us things. Yeah. It's always funny to hear the discrepancies between family stories. So the stories I had heard, the stories my grandma tells, the stories my Uncle Wallace tells, they're all different. And yeah, it's interesting. It's interesting also then like writing about some things about that and, you know, offending certain members of the family. Like, my mother had the fabulous idea to read this essay I wrote about Newfoundland to my grandmother, and my grandmother was very upset by it because there were things in it that I had been told by other family members there that she didn't believe were true. And, mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, that's memory, right? It's so cobbled together by so many things. It's like what we want to carry with us.
It's not the first time you offended your family by your writing.
Yeah. You know, it's, I guess, a choice that you make. And it's risky. There's lots at stake, but...
But you think it's important to...
I do,
speak it out.
Yeah.
What can you tell what the other part or the story happens that need to be said?
Oh, what another story that has offended my family. Yeah. Well, I wrote an essay that was published about my uncle, some things, yeah, that are family secrets that I talked about. And I actually don't know if they were offended, because I don't know if he's read it. And my mom is sure that he has, because she says he doesn't ask about me anymore on the phone. But who knows? You know, it could be because he has other things to think about.
Oh, well. Okay, well, just want to ask like a few questions before the end. Do you regret not being a doctor?
Sometimes in months when we don't have as much money as others. yeah, but on a global view, no.
No, eh?
Not at all.
Yeah. Do you remember when you, like, I don't know, when you're a kid, let's say like 5 or 6 or something, yeah, you dreamed of becoming someone or becoming
a hairdresser.
A hairdresser?
Yeah.
Awesome. What else?
An astronaut.
An astronaut?
Yeah. It was like either a hairdresser or an astronaut. Or, I wanted to also be a war correspondent.
A war correspondent.
Yeah. So, you know, it's interesting because that, yeah.
Yeah. Do you think how
that's always this sort of like sites of destruction, and has always intrigued me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was going to ask you, how do you relate what you dream of becoming with what you are now?
Yeah. Well, hairdressers talk to people. They cut their hair and make them beautiful and talk to people and talk about their stories. And now I just tell their stories. Writers and hairdressers are very alike.
You're a hairdresser in disguise.
Yeah. Yes. I cut your hair still sometimes.
Nice. Yeah, well, that's funny because I think it relates to what you are a lot. You always wanted to be a psychologist, and
no, I never wanted to be a psychologist.
Well, you never want to be a psychologist.
My mother is a psychologist.
You always wonder why you're not a psychologist.
Yes, fair enough.
That's and being a writer or being a musician is like totally answer that need of that being of you.
Yeah. Someone said something to me the other day, actually, another resident whose parents are also both, like, psychologists. She was like, you know, for our parents' generation, like, becoming a psychologist is, like, kind of like becoming an artist, but not really having the guts to become an artist. Yeah, it's kind of, I don't know. So for all the psychologists out there that may ever listen to this, I feel bad saying that. But for my mother, I can totally see that.
You realize that dream.
Yeah, trying.
What inspired you to take the leap of faith and not become a psychologist and become a writer? Like, why storytelling? Why writing? Was it a person? Was it a moment?
I feel like in my life, all the decisions I've made have not been any big decision or any big moment, but these little tiny steps that I take that they're so small that suddenly I'm like, whoa. I have already walked a mile down this path and I'm a writer. Like, and so exactly pinning down the moment that made me become that, I don't know. Yeah. It's just tiny little leaps of faith, I guess. Yeah. Until suddenly you're so far down the road where you can't really picture being on any other one. Yeah.
Who told the stories in your family?
Who told the stories? Well, my grandfather is a big storyteller. My mother is also very verbal and very storyteller. I actually come from a very performative family, as Yana can attest to. They're all musicians and, like, storytellers in their own right. Mm-hmm. My brother's a massive exaggerator, so, you know, he tells stories.
You're the only one who wrote those.
yeah, that's true. I'm the only one who's written them down, but, I mean, yeah. As I met people in Newfoundland as well, I saw that the sort of storytelling link, which was nice. That was important to sort of see. Yeah.
It's a verbal, oral culture, verbal culture, like people talk
very,
to each other.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. Also, I grew up, my parents were also ordained in the Salvation Army until I was 10. So I grew up hearing my parents give sermons every Sunday. So that is, to me, is totally storytelling. Yeah. And I loved hearing their sermons. They're both very good preachers.
Yeah. Do you think you'd be a good preacher?
Let's just keep it at storyteller.
Okay. Well, thanks, Lindsay.
Thanks, Yana.